The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Nicholas McGeegan has been music director of the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra in San Francisco for more than two decades and is a sought-after conductor of Baroque and modern orchestras around the world. Thank you very much for making time to speak with me.
This is a great pleasure.
You play harpsichord and forte piano as well as Baroque flute, and generally people don't start on those instruments. They start with piano or recorder or modern flute. What was your early introduction into music, and how did you get into the earlier instruments?
Well, I started playing the piano when I was about six, and I do not come from a musical household at all. Both my parents were painters, and my father an architect as well. So music was the thing that I could do and they couldn't, which of course is very nice when you're a kid. And you can't start the flute until you're big enough to stretch to cover the keys. So I didn't start the flute till I was about eight or nine. And I kept those up until I went to university when I was 18. And there I started to play the harpsichord a little bit. And one of the subjects you study at Cambridge, aside from drinking beer, is the acoustics of buildings and how musical instruments work. And I had a terrific teacher called Sir Nicholas Shackleton, who was a collector of 18th century wind instruments on the side. And he lent me an 18th century flute, and I got hooked. And it didn't hurt that he had a tenant living at the top of his house whose name was Christopher Hogwood. And Chris was very generous and allowed me to play sonatas and concerts. And then I joined his orchestra, the Academy of Ancient Music, and in fact played the flute on the very first recording. That was Thomas Arne's symphonies.
So when and how did you realize that music was your passion and calling in life?
I was thinking when I went to Cambridge of doing classics, but which is what I'd done at school, but changed to music and never regretted it.
What motivated you to make the leap from instrumentalist to conductor?
Well, I was lucky enough. I grew up partly in Nottinghamshire, which is in the middle of the country. It's Robin Hood country. And that county, as several of the Midland counties did, had an absolutely terrific music system in the schools. And indeed, they had Saturday morning music school. And people from all over the county would gather together. And we had an orchestra. People composed, could try their music out, choruses, and individual lessons. And also a county youth orchestra, which met once or twice a year, conducted by a chap called Muir Matheson, who was the conductor for an awful lot of the movies that were made in Pinewood Studios in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and early 70s. So it was an absolutely wonderful experience, which I think is no more. I think music programs everywhere, not just in the States, but also in England, have been cut back so much that I think all these county music programs no longer exist. But I'm a joyous beneficiary of that system.
There have been artificial barriers separating Baroque music from basically everything else, as though musicians had to choose one or the other, but not both. And those barriers are starting to break down a little now. You are helping that. You are known as a Baroque specialist, but you also regularly conduct modern orchestras.
Absolutely.
Why do you think those barriers exist?
Well, I think they existed. I think you're absolutely right that barrier is an artificial one. Part of it had to do, I think, in the 70s with, on behalf, if I could say, on the part of the early music brigade, that they were a bit prissy. The sort of the brown rice baroque, if I could call it that, that this was somehow a bit holier than thou, a bit purer, a bit more vegetarian. And then the other end, the symphony orchestras were rather disdainful of all this and thought that we were just too precious for words. And those barriers, as you say, have come down. There are people like me who come from the Baroque camp who go and work with modern symphony orchestras and love doing it. And there are people, much more importantly, like Simon Rattle, who is obviously the music director of the Berlin Philharmonic, but also conducts the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, which is one of the most famous period instrument orchestras in the UK, and has done Mozart operas at Glyndebourne using period instruments. So a lot of us now do straddle both Baroque and modern playing. And there are only a few people left of the disdainful variety who think that everything we do is absolute rubbish. I think André Previn is one. Pinchas Zukerman is another, who just hate it. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't hate what they do.
Does it make a difference whether you're leading a modern instrument group or a period instrument group? I mean, do you approach it any differently? Or is leading an orchestra pretty similar no matter what kind of instruments or repertory they're playing?
Well, all the people who played in period instrument orchestras have come from the modern orchestra world. Very few of them, possibly the odd harpsichordist or lute player, has not been in an orchestra. Certainly all the violinists, cellists, flute players and so on. So that's the same for period and modern. I mean, the rules of the game are essentially the same. You don't waste people's time. You try to be well prepared and you put on a good concert. We are, after all, only entertainers. And so it's important to do all those things. And it doesn't matter what the instruments are. That's the way it goes.
You've done some unusual collaborations with the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, such as commissioning a one-act opera, really reaching across the centuries using period instruments for a contemporary composition. Would you talk about that project a little bit? How did it come about?
Well, it was done for the 25th anniversary of the orchestra. And in the Bay Area, we have a lot of great composers. John Adams lives fairly close to me, for example, and I live in Berkeley. And in San Francisco, there's a wonderful composer called Jake Heggie, who writes a lot of very good operas and is a terrific writer of vocal music, writes a lot for Frederico von Stade, for example. And since he's a good friend of mine, and he likes coming to our concerts, we thought it was a good idea to actually ask him to write us a piece, which would be based on classical themes. And I mean, like ancient Greek myths, so the sort of theme that would have been quite normal for an 18th century cantata. We asked him to write one which would be a modern retelling of the same sort of story that someone like Handel might have used in a cantata or a small opera. And he came up with this wonderful piece, which was called To Hell and Back, which was, and is, based on the myth of Persephone. And it's an absolutely terrific piece. And then he went one stage further, which is even better, that he had a Baroque singer, or Baroque opera singer, as one of the characters, and the other singer was a cabaret singer, or is a cabaret singer, and it was Patti LuPone who did the premiere of this. So that was a terrific mixed media thing between Baroque, modern, classical, and Broadway. And it's an incredibly moving piece, beautifully written. And Jake went to the orchestra, went round all the players and said, now tell me exactly how your instrument works. What can we do to do this? How do we make that work? What sort of sounds can your instrument do that a modern oboe can't do, for example? And he took note of all that and then scored this piece absolutely beautifully for the orchestra, came to all the rehearsals, futzed around with it a little bit, particularly the harpsichord part, for example, to make it more idiomatic. And so the result is not just something that we received in the mail, but something that was actually done with the orchestra on the shop floor, if you like. So it was like being there, having Handel or Corelli coming up with a new piece.
So what music do you listen to when you're not working?
Ah, you're assuming I listen to any music when I'm not working. I listen to things that I couldn't possibly have an interest in performing.
Like what?
Sort of Portuguese fado folk music, and I particularly have a naughty passion for English punk rock. which Ian Dury particularly, which I just love listening to. It's very funny, it's very sarcastic, very bitter. And I'm never, ever going to play it. But I'm not the sort of person, I think, along with a lot of musicians, who have classical music on in the background. I tend to be an NPR speech type of guy, or the BBC Radio 4, listening to good speech. Rather, I don't even know in my car if I've actually got the classical music station in San Francisco tuned on the car radio.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned NPR because you have a lot of non-musical interests that are very much like a lot of public radio listeners. You are a foodie and you're interested in wine. You're a crossword puzzler and a gardener.
Absolutely.
So it's easy to do crossword puzzles while you're on the go, but how do you find time to tend roses at your home, for example, when you're so busy and you're traveling so extensively?
The nice thing about the Bay Area is that almost anything will grow there. Of course, we haven't got any water right now, so that's a little bit of a problem. But roses tend to not require one's full attention. One can prune them back and then they flower. And I try never to have roses that only flower once a year, because if they do, that time is almost bound to be when I'm away. So I have roses which bloom for a long time. Some of them have musical associations. There's a lovely climbing rose called Handel, for example, and a beautiful one called Excellenz von Schubert, which is a beautiful... So there are roses there that are sort of a bit out of the ordinary but have musical associations.
Since you perform all over the world, I'm wondering what kind of similarities and differences that you see between American audiences and those in Europe and elsewhere.
I think there are quite a lot of differences even with audiences within the United States, particularly university audiences. And they're, since I live in Berkeley and I'm now in New Haven, they're remarkably similar in a sense that there's a lot of concerts and a lot of music making happens where no money changes hands. Free concerts, lunchtime concerts in art galleries, that kind of thing. And I find that is tremendous, and that's very European. In London, for example, there are lots and lots and lots of churches, most of which don't have any congregations because the population isn't there anymore, in the city of London, for example. And a lot of them are used at lunchtimes or early evening for classical music performance. And lots of people come and they bring their lunch. And they can have an hour of Haydn string quartets or something in a beautiful building. And I went at the Centre of British Art here in New Haven. I went to a terrific lunchtime concert a couple of days ago. Free, was packed. And the Jasper Quartet played part of a Schumann quartet, which I think was the finest performance of it I've ever heard. And it didn't cost me a cent. So that's thrilling. There are differences between America and Europe. One is that I think you see more young people very often at European concerts. And perhaps that people slightly more tend to bring their families out to a concert rather than decide to go to a concert and then look for a babysitter. As a family outing, I find that's very good. And there are lots of family concerts to make sure that happens. And because of that, relatively young people, I'm talking people in their 20s, have had a fairly strong tradition of concert going already, which is not necessarily the case in the States.
Yeah.
People tend to come to concerts a little later in life. And I think that's a shame, obviously.
Often people who aren't generally into classical music will tell me they find Baroque music appealing. And I'm wondering if you hear that too. And I'm wondering if you have any insight into why Baroque music is able to make inroads with people who don't otherwise listen to classical music.
Yeah, I think you're right in one way, but if I may say so, not in another. The right is yes, Baroque music is extraordinarily approachable. It does all the right things. It sounds very nice. You sort of know a lot of the time where you are in the piece. And also some of it, like Vivaldi, isn't terribly long. And a lot of it is played on the radio, which means even if you've not heard that particular Vivaldi concerto, you have some familiarity with Vivaldi because you might have some on in the car, or it might be played in a restaurant, which of course is quite common these days. The other side, which I found is very interesting, has to do with Disney Hall in Los Angeles, which when it opened, the average age of the audience went down by about 20 years. Mm. Because young people came as the hippest place in LA to bring your date. And it didn't matter whether they were playing Mozart, Messiaen, or Lutoslawski. It was an evening out in the hippest place in town with dinner beforehand, Cosmos in the intermission, or whatever. And that is a tremendously exciting thing. And because perhaps some of those people did not have a background of classical music but know a lot of movies, really dissonant, frightening classical music just reminds them of some of the music they hear in films. But whereas, you know, say the murder scene, the shower scene in Psycho is pretty, for its time, very, very modern music. But once you see what's happening in the Hitchcock film, it seems perfectly appropriate. But there will be other people who would just say it sounds dissonant and horrid, and they'd like to have something that sounds sweet and charming. The kiss of death for music is dowdy concert halls with no... the second you think of a concert as a concert, instead of a concert as part of an enjoyable evening, which includes dinner and, you know, it's a date, then that's much more fun. If there's nothing to do in the intermission, there's nowhere to eat either before or afterwards, then I think you're bound to get an audience that is rather all of the same age. And if the seats are uncomfortable and the program book assumes you know everything and everything is not particularly welcoming, and you feel, oh, I've got to have a PhD in classical music to understand this concert, then I think it's all wrong. Music is, after all, about emotions, and they should speak to us all without having to have a degree in it.
So what projects do you have coming up on the horizon?
What's on the horizon? Well, right now I've got a concert this very afternoon, and tomorrow Yale is an incredibly indulgent organization, and they've allowed me to give a talk at the Center for British Art tomorrow. The topic is pets in the 18th century, so I'm talking about dogs and cats and birds, and in art, but mostly in poetry and music. And that's kind of the sort of cheerful and somewhat silly project that it's great fun to do on the road. And with the internet, you can look up all kinds of things. You don't have to carry a library around with you all the time. And it's absolutely just a fun thing to do. And then I'm going home. I get my first day off in 6 weeks on Wednesday. I can hardly wait. I've got the New York Philharmonic coming up, which will be lovely in March, just around Bach's birthday. And this year it's terrific for me because Handel, Haydn, Mendelssohn and Purcell all have anniversaries. And so I'm going around the world doing lots of music by all those four composers, which is a great treat. We just, last month was Mendelssohn's 250th birthday. He was born exactly a week before Lincoln and Darwin. So it was a very good month in 1809. And so did 2 weeks of, solid 2 weeks of nothing but Mendelssohn, which was very nice. And Handel's coming up in April, and then Haydn in March. So it's endless creations and messiahs and that sort of thing. And that's just fab. Couldn't imagine a nicer way to earn a living.
Well, Nicholas McGeegan, thank you very much for making time to speak with me.
My pleasure. Lovely to chat.